So yeah, there's a. I already talked on a wide variety of things. And there's, if any point you want clarification on anything from like, you know, the details of intentional community living, conflict resolution, like how much privacy you have, how much, you know, connection you have with other people, or anything from that, from the dual power strategy of revolutionary change, I'm open to questions.
Is there kind of, I know that Twin Oaks basically functions as an anarchist community, pretty much, right? The way people are, you know, voted to do different jobs and cycle through and everything. Is there a concept at Twin Oaks or at other communities that are not specifically anarchist communities that that is the model that they're using? Like, do people realize that they're using an anarchist model?
Yeah.
And if not, like, is there, like, you know, are you or other people, like, trying to educate them that that is what they're indeed doing?
Yeah, well, one of the... Yeah, like I already said already, a lot of intentional communities people don't know about anarchism, and they may operate in very anarchist ways, you know, consensus or whatever, but they refuse to use the word, or they don't even know about the word, or its correct meaning. And Twin Oaks definitely, you know, has some anarchist qualities, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's entirely anarchist. That, for example, Twin Oaks uses representative democracy structures instead of direct democracy or consensus. And in terms of educating them about anarchism, that's one of the goals of this one organization I'm a part of, Anarchist Communitarian Network, which basically hopes to educate intentional communities in intentional communities people about anarchism and educate anarchists about intentional communities, you know, vice versa.
Two questions. One, you said, one of the virtues of intentional communities is that they're self-selecting, and then you said that they can provide a model of what an anarchist society looks like. The problem I see with that is in anarchist society, we're not going to be self-selecting. It's going to be everybody who's born in there. So I'm feeling like, you know, it can give us some ideas, but it doesn't, it seems like it might not be dealing with, you know, some of the issues that would come up when, you know, after the revolution, when the world's anarchist, to be a little bit silly about it. The other question I have is, you were talking about, you know, like working class people, poor people, people of color, it would be to their economic advantage to form intentional communities. I'm wondering how initially accessible it is. Like, it sounds like, okay, fine, once you join, but you need a lot of funds to get started, like to buy a house, even a collective house, in the city, and then I would imagine starting an intentional community off in a rural area is even more of a task and even more economically difficult.
Yeah, okay, so in terms of the first thing about self-selecting, I would say that actually that's an essential part, I would see, to anarchism, in the sense that it's the same thing as a freedom association, in that people choose who they live with or who they don't live with. I see that as being one of the core parts about anarchism, not having anyone thrust upon you, you know, in your environment, or not being kept away forcefully from people you want to associate with.
Yeah. But, I mean, like, in a, forgive the phrase, post-revolutionary society, you know, you would have people born into your community, raised there, and maybe they just don't fit in, but they're still part of the community, or, you know, they fit in certain ways but are troublemakers in certain ways. It's not self-selecting in the same way an intentional community is. Are you advocating exiling them? Is this anarchist society, or I guess I'm pointing out a weakness in your, what I see as a weakness in your argument about it being a complete model.
It's kind of problematic to compare, like, an anarchist society in an intentional community living in a capitalist society, because I feel like, personally, any sort of project that I do as an anarchist, I'm going to be self-selecting with who I work with. Just by being an individual, I'm not going to work with a capitalist on a political issue, you know what I mean? And if I'm going to live in an intentional anarchist community, I'm going to live with anarchists. So I think there has to be some sort of set of selectivity with who I'm going to deal with. And I would, you know, I'd like to live with people who I can personally get along with.
Oh, I wasn't challenging that aspect of it. I was just challenging the... It's... I'm pointing out a weakness in it as... of it as a model for a future anarchist society. Because it's self-selecting, you wouldn't have the same... necessarily all the same problems.
You can have some of the same problems, though, and you have to start somewhere. I mean, yeah. It's not like these problems are just going to go away after the revolution. Everybody's going to turn into saints or something.
Why would we create a model for an anarchist future now? Like, I mean, you can't have a perfect anarchist future now, so we have to create a model, an anarchist model now for now.
Okay. So. And also, you mentioned about people being... You mentioned about people being born into the community, and that happens all the time in regular intentional communities. You know, children live in a lot of these, and, you know, even at Twin Oaks, since I've lived there, about 2 or 3 babies have been born there. I guess the trick with intentional communities, which one of the problems in intentional communities, which could very well be a problem with anarchism, is that a lot of times the people that children that are born in intentional communities... or at least in communes, you know, which is a specific type of intentional community, don't want to stay when they grow up, you know. When they get old enough to live on their own, they want to live mainstream, you know, lifestyle. And so that might... the trick is, how do you solve that? How do you make children, you know, that are born there and raised there, interested in it and wanting to maintain that lifestyle as they get older? And maybe that problem will happen in anarchist society, you know, if you have a revolution and then, you know, anarchist society and then the next generation... you know, gets fed up and wants to go back to some kind of authoritarian or consumerist way of living. You also brought up about the economics of forming intentional communities. And there's different ways that has been worked around. There's many different ways of organizing intentional communities, many ways of forming it, many ways of having an intentional community, one of which is, you know, squatting, which people are well known about. And that's totally for free, and a lot of homeless people live that way. And then there's also, like, Catholic worker houses, which, you know, is a form of intentional community where some group of dedicated activist types usually form these houses, and then they open it up to really poor people or the homeless people. And then you can just be creative, I would say, and have an open dialogue about ways about how you can create the intentional community. Like, in terms of, like, rural, you know, areas, farmland, you could... maybe find some really dirt cheap land, you know, really cheap unused farmland. Like, for instance, in Anarchy Magazine, they talked about all this farmland that's like, you can, like, $20 for a house and like thousands of acres and stuff, really cheap in North Dakota. So if you just look really closely and hardly and for like cheap land, you can probably find it really easy. The skill is learning where to look. And you also, it's also a trick of finding interested people that have the same goals to form the intentional community. People that, you know, are knowledgeable in certain areas and also just have the same vision of how they want to live.
I have a question. I'm from Brazil, and I was in Philadelphia for 2 months, and they have a community in West Philly, and about getting people, like, from the neighborhood involved. In Brazil, the way I see it, we have a lot of communities, like millions of people living in communities. Right now, it's just 9,000 families just squatted of land and are living in a community like that. And I was wondering, because in Philadelphia, what I saw was the community living kind of separate from the people from the neighborhood. They're not getting involved that much on what the work they are doing, and all the things that they do, the community does, is basically much based on the issues that they face and not on what the neighborhood are facing. And so that's a really problem, like, on communication and how getting involved and how, like, the buy houses around West Philly, which is really, really cheap, and like everybody get together in one group, buy a house, and people live there. They have, I guess, like 3 houses now, but they're not like getting like the community from the neighborhood involved in that procedure, like buying house together. And for this is like an anarchist community, like, and for the other side in Brazil, the the big communities, not only from the country's area, but also in the cities. Like in São Paulo, we have around 15 squats downtown. Each building has 100 families living there, and they're all really, really well organized. They have meetings every week. Everything is the site collective. That's like work. People who works in the building, fixing up the building. They have free classes, capoeira classes, which is martial arts from Brazil, mm-hmm. and they're really well organized. And that is some anarchists involved with the. But like, there's a lot of people, a lot of anarchists that is not involved in that. You know, so it's basically totally different. Like, you know, the communities already exist, but there is not that much anarchists involved. And he is like most like of the communities are. Anarchists made it by, and the community where they are is not involved. So, I don't know.
And that's partly what I meant by, you know, having the intentional communities movement and the anarchist movement meet halfway. You know, like you mentioned, the not explicitly anarchist intentional community is sometimes more anarchistic than the anarchist community. And so, so the trick is, you know, to have. Intentional communities that act really anarchist, recognize that that's anarchism that they're practicing, and also informing them of a critique of state and capitalism per se. I think that, you know, a lot of times intentional communities organize in anarchist ways, but don't necessarily understand that, you know, capitalism will always form, you know, class inequalities, and that hierarchy is the root of, you know, all this stuff, you know, as anarchists. And, which unfortunately leads to a lot of intentional communities people being reformist and Naderites and stuff. And as far as you said about like intentional communities interacting with the greater surrounding community, I see that as being really essential for a community organizing. And at Twin Oaks, you know, fortunately, a lot of people are active in the surrounding community. Like some people are active in some programs teaching children how to read in the local area. Some people are active in this. What's that organization that Jimmy Carter works at? Building houses. Yeah, yeah. Some people work on that. Yeah, some people work in. Yeah, some people work in regular this community organizations and stuff. And I see that as important, maintaining good relations and stuff. Because one of the things that I see that you definitely would not want in an intentional community is people to see you as isolated freaks or as a bunch of, you know, punks that come in and trash the neighborhood and then leave, which definitely has happened, unfortunately. I also think that if you form intentional communities through community organizing, you know, if you have the neighborhood assemblies and later on they form land trust or collective houses, that it's far more likely to be, you know, accepted by the surrounding community and maybe even successful because you have this foundation base to draw from of local support. And I also think it's just essential just to kind of blend together also the broad community organizing and intentional community organizing as much as possible. I think the distinction is really important in that, in a way, intentional communities is the most advanced form of community organizing since, you know, it is self-managed and done intentionally. But at the same time, you shouldn't forget about the importance of regular community organizing and just the people that you happen by chance to be living near and not disregard them either.
Have you ever heard anyone else that talks about the same kind of dual power strategy that you were talking about earlier? Because I find that really interesting. I thought about it myself quite a bit. And is there anybody else thinking that way? Or
It's interesting because like a lot of people talk about dual power, like NEFAC just was right before us. And some people have talked about dual power through, you know, alternative institutions. That's kind of by definition what dual power is. Like there's this great book on AINFO's radio. What is it? Like Getting Free, a Sketch of Democratic Autonomous Neighborhoods by James Sherrod. Yeah. That explained, that basically says a lot of what I'm saying now, but the structure there is neighborhood assemblies and workplace assemblies, which I agree with, but also I take it a step further by saying intentional communities as well. And I guess some people in the intentional communities movement have talked about dual power this way, but they would never use the word dual power or anarchist or revolution. The words that they've used, I'm thinking particularly of Alan Butcher, who wrote about parallel culture. And
what culture?
Parallel, you know, existing at the same time. Yeah. Well, basically, he explains the same thing as dual power, but he talks about the cultural aspects and creating an alternative culture. And this might go back also to, you know, the hippies, 60s counterculture, where some hippie types thought that by forming communes in the 60s that you can create alternative. These ideas all kind of blend together at different points. I think the trick is, of course, to make it really explicit, coherent, and to point out how the similarities between and the essential connections between, you know, creating a different culture, creating different economic sustainability, and revolution, self-sufficiency, all that.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's probably hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions of people in North America who would like to live in a different way but don't have the resources available to them to do that. Mm-hmm. And as a revolutionary strategy, it seems to me it's maybe one of the least possible but almost most hopeful ways to do it, because at a certain point, if you had functioning communities that were relatively self-sufficient from the mainstream society, and they were working and they were providing an example to other just regular people who were interested in, they're looking around, they're thinking, well, why do I hate my life so much, and these people are having a good time, and why don't I try that too? And then if you had enough sort of desertion from the mainstream institutions and you could accommodate that, the threat of a good example at that point would become probably, I think, more than the system could deal with. And then you'd have people just saying, well, why are we taking all of this crap every day? Yeah. And that, I think, could be a massive upsurge. Yeah. It's just a question of putting it together, getting your hands dirty and doing it. But
yeah. I mean, this isn't a refutation of your argument, but just to point out that if it did begin to evolve into a threat, such radical intentional communities would be dealing with a lot of demonization from the mainstream press and probably police raids on trumped up charges.
Yeah, yeah. But if you were, I mean, obviously you'd have to be prepared for that. But if you're in communities all across, you know, mm-hmm. the continent, I mean, they can say all kinds of shitty things about you on TV. But if you live next door to someone, mm-hmm. they're going to know that you're not a some kind of vampire or ghoul that comes out at night and sucks the kidneys out of your children. They're going to know that. So, I mean, it's probably, I think, one of the ways that you could avoid the demonization that we already get in the media.
Hmm.
Because people know you.
Right.
And you have
hmm.
to do that. And we don't talk enough, I think, as anarchists, to people who don't look like us or talk like us or smell like us or whatever. We have to do that much more. We're not doing it enough. I mean, we're agreeing, we're sitting in this conference agreeing with each other and then debating tiny points of doctrine, and no one cares, no one gives a shit, no one. Like, there's 300 million people on the continent. What are we going to do?
Right.
We have to do it.
I had a question that was partly a response to what you said and to what you said, but it's also directed to you. One concern that I would have, if it became more popular, more commonly found across North America and maybe other parts of the world, and it was hard to demonize it because people knew who it was, some people might be attracted to it. And if it isn't explicitly political, is it possible that somebody might start to co-opt it? I mean,
I think it would have to be explicitly political. Yeah, absolutely.
So is this a problem that some of these intentional communities that exist today are not thinking in more terms of explicit politics and policy, and that this might lead to capture in the future?
Yeah, I mean, definitely I would say that's one of the reasons why you should have explicitly anarchist, you know, consciousness and stuff. And that, you know, there are, unfortunately, some intentional communities which have, you know, gurus or, you know, persons that looked at as being, like, the person with all the answers. And this also relates, you know, to the tyranny of structurelessness. If you have communities without structure, that kind of guru thing can come about, too. And just in general, I think a lot of times, you know, without having the anarchist consciousness in intentional communities, that can lead to all kinds of either abstract spiritual stuff which doesn't lead to an explicit political threat or to reformist politics. In terms of what you were saying about, like, was it creating the alternative to the mainstream and all that, that idea has been called, like, hollowing out the capitalist society so that eventually it loses the internal support and stuff, which personally I see as being the only real form of revolution out there. The thing is, it's a big fight within the anarchist movement that if you want to convince people of going the route of alternative institutions and cooperative living, the trick is to show that that would be an effective means of revolution. And a lot of anarchists kind of glamorize revolution as being a one-time thing or being all dramatic or big conflict. And so it kind of like is a letdown, I guess, for a lot of what manarchy kind of anarchists who want to go out there and fight, when in fact what we're talking about is living together and who were cleaning the dishes and stuff.
I think that in many ways, I think the Scottish fellow Ramsay said earlier, everybody looked all stunned, but he said, I think that whatever is happening here is largely irrelevant. I can't say it with a Scottish accent. And it's largely irrelevant what we're talking about here, because mm-hmm. it's not a question of mobilizing 100 people to come to an anarchist conference to be anarchists. It's a question of what kind of, I mean, it to some degree it does have to be explicitly political, but if you talk, say, there's a lot of people you know, down on the primitivists here, for example, which I think is great, but as far as it goes, though, they're irrelevant completely. Like, we I don't know if there's any primitivists in the audience, but I personally think that they're completely irrelevant. They're not going to get anybody moving because their critique is so far out there that it doesn't. Nobody wants to get away from time, as far as I know. Like, there's no mass movement going to be based on, we should stop having time. It doesn't make any fucking sense. You're loon bags. But we have to realize that to some degree, we ourselves are also loon bags. We're debating points of revolutionary strategy for a revolution that doesn't exist except for a very select demographic of people who are currently summit hopping, and that's what's happening. And we have to realize that we're irrelevant too, and we're going to be irrelevant until we can inflame the popular imagination with our ideas. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that is to organize in communities. And other than that, we're a bunch of people throwing rocks at police, and that's it. Mm-hmm. That's all we got.
I'd like to say something to add. I think in Brazil we have a really great example, which is the landless movement. It's around 3 million people right now. And even though all the oppression that the government does against them and all the media works against them, if you do right now research about who is more popular, MSC is more popular than the government. Everybody. And they don't, I mean, they do the actions, they are pretty much like, they don't go around like doing press interviews, they don't like, you know, like doing many big propaganda at all, but like everybody agrees with them because if we know that we have a lot of, like, we're never going to read a good thing about MSC on the media in Brazil, never. But everybody completely agrees with it because it's something that there is no way to, I mean, to not see what they are doing. And what they are doing is basically a natural, is to supply the national needs from a human being, which is like have a piece of land and plant their own food and live there. And one of the reasons that the government is really scared and use all this oppression against them is because they totally live without any needs of having any kind of relationship with the government at all. You know, so that's the reason. If people will start to realize that, everybody would be like, hey, I want to be doing it, you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I mean, and people already kind of know that, because even knowing that we have all just a huge work against them, has been media and police oppression. They created a special police only to work with the MSC. The militaries are being like, investigating the MSC has been 8 years that all the military training is based on MSC, like the enemy, and the enemies is the peasants. So all this huge work against them, we still have all the public opinion like in favor of amnesty, because I mean, it's in the face, like there's no way to cover it, you know. And yeah, it's like just to add this so, example.
You're like saying along what, like with what he says, that they deal with the police and the demonization and stuff by having strong community relations as opposed to being confrontational. Is the landless movement, yeah, is that how they deal with the police? Or
they're really no violent movement, yeah. And when basically the police pretty much, like when they it's a natural reaction basically on their actions, who took the front line is women and children. It's not because they are sent to, because they want to, and that's kind of create a protection. But they really know violence. They don't have any guns at all. They don't like do any guerrilla thing. And basically, sometimes, like, of course, like they have like confrontations, like people throwing rocks, and but most of the times they are really, really non-violent. The action that they do is pretty much like, it's huge actions, but most of the times it's like no violent. And when, if it happens, like people throwing rocks or whatever, it's like basically self-defense reaction, which is of course like more than normal. Yeah.
I see that as being a lot more justifiable if you want to defend the actions of anarchists and some police you know, brutality on anarchists. Like it's hard to defend to non-anarchists when our anarchist comrades go out and throw Molotov cocktails at police and stuff and throw rocks and initiate these attacks and stuff, compared to if you had like an anarchist community where people are living together and the police raid that. You know, one is, they're clearly on the offensive position, the other they're defensive. And so if you want to go for, you know, the victim position and say that the anarchists were mistreated by the police, I think you have a stronger argument if you're just living together and working together, as opposed to going out there fighting the cops, you know, throwing rocks at them, charging the lines and all that. As far as demonization goes, I think the mainstream media in the state were demonized anarchists, you know, whatever we do, regardless of whatever we do. And one example of this is that this is commune close by to Twin Oaks called Acorn. And there is, the media came and, you know, did a story on it. And there's this big, there are like two big gardens in Acorn, one that's like for a community garden, CSA. Community supported agriculture, and then there's another garden that was just for the Acorn community themselves. And the person that was giving the media guy a tour said, you know, this garden here is just for us, we're just doing it for ourselves. And then in the caption they showed this guy's picture, and in the newspaper under the caption it said, we're doing it all for ourselves. So and that's like just a subtle form of misrepresentation. I think there's a lot more. And in fact, some anarchist intentional community people that I know have made the argument that the Branch Davidians were just an innocent little religious cult, and that they were demonized and attacked by the state that way. I guess it could go both ways, but I think that if you do like basically have any form of guns or violent rhetoric or anything, and you live on an intentional community, that might give the state more justification or the media more hype and reason to be against you. But they'll be against you regardless. The thing is, how much substance are you going to give them?
Yeah, I think he's been waiting to ask a question for a while.
This is off the subject now, so if you want to respond.
I was just going to say that if you're effective in what you're doing, they're going to find a way to demonize you regardless. You know, I mean, which is not to say that it's, you know, it's not going to make it easier for them if you're, you know, if you're hoarding weapons and stuff. But either way, they are going to they'll find a way to demonize you. They'll find a way to, like, you know, raid you or whatever. And I think that the most effective thing that you can do in your defense, and at that point, as far as support, is having good ties with the community, you know, is really being, you know, it sounds hokey, but just like being good neighbors, you know,
yeah.
Realizing that, you know, people know, like, oh yeah, they're okay, you know, they've never hurt anybody before. And I think that's the kind of thing that slowly wins people over, whether they would consider themselves anarchists or not, at least at first, you know, you have to plant that seed.
So the question's not that like exciting. It has to do a lot with like the legalities of living in intentional communities and making sure that they're permanent. I was reading an article in Communities Magazine about this sort of thing. How, like, I mean, you can start an intentional community just about anywhere, but things might happen, like the land that you're sitting on, maybe someone owns it and then they die, and then all of a sudden, like, you know, someone inherits the land and then your intentional community is no longer existing. Or, I mean, there's so many thousands of possibilities that could happen. Twin Oaks obviously somehow owns the land that there is a land trust, so I'm just kind of curious about maybe what type of legal structure is in place. I mean, it's I don't know if it's held by, like, who, the land, how is it held? One person deed or like a 501c3 or how?
Actually, your unique tax status, it's a 501d, which is the same, same status as a monastery. Actually, I think somewhere in the bylaws is a statement of beliefs, which is vague Unitarian thing that we believe in goodness and good things and ecology. Yeah.
And possibly get a hold of sort of any.
Yeah, well, actually, the Twin Oaks and the East Wind, which is another big commune, the sister commune of Twin Oaks, on our websites, the bylaws are up there.
Oh, are they really?
Yeah, so
what's
it's www.twinoaks.org. Okay. And I think East Wind is, you know, eastwind.org.
Now, let's see, so it's on a land trust?
No, it's actually that it's, you know, the 501D, where the whole community is a non-profit corporation where the whole community owns it. If you join as a member, you become officially recognized, like, you know, by the government's eyes as being like a business partner. So in a way, if you like want to sign your tax forms, you'd say that you're a businessman and you're a part owner of a business.
Well, why that's important is because we want to create these intentional communities, or say if we're thinking about it as an anarchist-like community, you want to create them permanently, right? Mm-hmm. And you want it so, like, if five people leave, those five people don't take the community away, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that the community structure is still in place and that more people can just come in and make sure that that's there. And I really see that as, like, a major issue, even just, like, forming an anarchist collective, you know? That doesn't really create it creates a structure between just those individuals that are there, and sometimes when those individuals leave, that's gone. But what I like about sort of this idea of creating a space, like a physical location where this is going to exist further, I feel that's a really good way to resist, and a really powerful way to keep a permanent sort of resistance there, as long as you can find people to come back in.
Yeah. Once you get more of a sense of security and stuff, knowing that you have a space.
What exactly do you need to have to get the 501D status, like a fuzzy statement of beliefs?
Oh, but then also, since you're technically a non-profit corporation, you have to go through, you have to have officially, in paper, the whole hierarchical, bureaucratic thing of a president and a vice president and a treasurer. And so it's kind of interesting at Twin Oaks, you know, we do have a representative democracy and we don't use the traditional state methods of organizing. So with our, you know, official position of president and vice president, it's just in paper only. So every year we have, required by law, a community meeting where we get together and we choose, vote on the next president and vice president. And since it's a meaningless title, you know, a lot of people don't really care. And so we do it over dinner time and ask people, hey, you want to be president? And, oh, okay. And Twin Oaks, like, makes, I think, about $1 million or something by selling hammocks. And so on your resume, you can say you're a president of a $1 million corporation. But let's see. Twin Oaks, it sells all the hammocks that Pier 1 Imports sells.
Nice.
Or it makes all them.
I've had some bad hammock experiences, so I need a good one.
Well, I can vouch for it. I've had mine for several years.
Product endorsement.
Yeah, that's good.
I was thinking one idea to bring up about primitivism and the different kinds of anarchist ideologies is I think that intentional communities movement could play a large part in realizing both primitivism and syndicalism, oddly enough. Like, for instance, with primitivism, if you want to learn how to live wild, you know, live without domestication and all that, I see actually intentional communities as being the best kind of environment for that, you know, where you buy some wooded forest land.
Paperwork.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess you could, like, squat some forest land and run naked without talking.
But,
yeah. So I think, like, the thing is, you have a group of people and you intentionally live together in some form. And, like, you know, there's different kinds of primitivism. Some is just agricultural-based. Right. So you could form an agricultural-based commune. And I think the key thing with primitivism is creating the actual knowledge and stuff. And one of the primitivist critiques of civilization is that civilization destroys our knowledge of how to live self-sufficiently. And one of the things I was emphasizing here is learning how to live self-sufficiently, again, the whole DIY ethic and all that. And as far as syndicalism goes, syndicalism oftentimes talks about, you know, the big general strike and stuff. But one of the critiques I've always had of the general strike is, how would you survive economically, you know, during a general strike and you're not getting paid or anything? And I think that if you have all these alternative institutions and intentional communities that are still making all the economic goods and food and stuff that you need, that can provide the economic structure that could support a working class during the general strike.
I guess the interesting thing about the Brazilians to me is that they're poor as hell, but they're still about 1,000 years ahead of us in North America. I find that really interesting, and I'm not sure what it means, but they're so far ahead of us. And I was talking to Akinari from Japan there last night, and he was saying, you know, North America is so far ahead of Japan, but it's interesting that, you know, that the Brazilians are light years ahead of us. It's incredible.
How far are
they ahead of Japan?
Well, Japan is sort of living in a galaxy long ago, time far, far away or something.
I just guess this is off the topic, but I'm curious about the MST in Brazil. I've read it about before, and it sounds amazing, but I've never gotten a sense of what their actual organizational structure is like beyond the sort of cooperative squatting level.
The way they organize themselves is basically, you can go by, like, first of all, by one camp. They do an occupation, and they have the part of the land who they start to work with the government to get the land legalized. And when they start to get pieces of the land legalized, they have a priority list, like people who has more priority to go to that land, which is more safe. So those people move to the land and they start to work, like building houses and doing, like, starting creating plantations. So, and they have weekly meetings. Everything's the side collective. And people, like, on the legal part of the camp, people can decide if you have your piece of land, and you can decide if you want to do a plantation by yourself or if you want to do a plantation together with some other people, and, like, get together all the lands and do a plantation together. Because some people, like, they have their own way of doing the plantations, and basically, and they have a community plantation piece of land, which the community piece of land, and all the plantations that the money is used, like, for I don't know, for things for the community, which could be, like, rent a truck to work in the land, or rent a bus to go to a national meeting in the capital from Brazil, you know, so everybody in the camp could go. Or, I don't know, raise money for something else. And the private, I mean, the other pieces of land, which could be, like, someone working by themselves in, you know, their own piece of land, or, like, working together, just all this share it, all the plantations. Like, if I'm planting beans, I will share with someone who's planting coffee, and everybody chants everything. And then from that camp, they get someone who would be, like, the spokesperson for the camp, which the way that you choose that person, I mean, depends on each camp. Sometimes it's just, like, elected. Sometimes people, volunteers, are, and this is totally a rotate position. And everything is decided collectively. So if everybody decides, like, oh, this person should be the spokesperson, or we should vote to see who is going to be the spokesperson, or, like, I don't know, they decide, like, it depends on each camp. It's totally, like, free and autonomous. And then we have each person from each camp, and they, I'm now, like, talking about states. because it's like our own Brazil, so that's the way they organize themselves. Each state, they have one person which will represent an area, like South Area, North Area, and that they will meet on the capital from the state, where each capital, they have an officer kind of working, it's called secretary, and they in there, like, they have people working there, working with the bureaucratic stuff, which, like, how, like, the occupations, the legal things from the occupations, how the process going on with the government institution, and if the government will give the land or not, how the lawyers are working. There's a lot of lawyers who does voluntary work for MSC, and, like, legal issues, also, like, publications. They have a lot of publications. Paulo Freire, he wrote, like, a lot of books, and he just gave all those books, like, rights to IMSG, so they sell the books, and all the money goes to IMSG, and they have a lot of other, like, Sebastian Salgado, which is, like, a photographer, he's pretty famous, and he did a work with IMSG, and he donated a lot of things, like, from his work to IMSG, so they have all this thing there, so if you knew, and they have a newspaper, which is free, and if you want, like, you just go to the secretary, each capital from state they have, and so, and the secretary is also a place where those people who represent the area, like the south area from the state, the north area from the state, they will meet, and they will discuss, like, the necessities, what's going on, the projects, if they have a proposal, like, oh, we want to do, I don't know, like, an action there, they need people there. So that's where the discussion, and each state, they have one person who will represent the state, which goes to a national meeting, and they have a national secretary, which is in São Paulo as well, where they have, like, a lot of people doing working with international relationships, national issues, like, education. They have different sections. They separate each secretary that has different sections. It goes from education to health to legal to security. That's the way they organize themselves, basically. And you have also, besides, because the MST is a landless movement, peasant movement, right in the urban area, there's a homeless workers movement. And they also do the same kind of work as MST, and they work together with MST, and they are the one who has the squats downtown São Paulo, and they just did, 2 months ago, 9,000 families, they squat a piece of land close to São Paulo. It's a city, it's like 12,000 people living there, and they organize, like, they already, like, set up a way of organizing themselves, which is 300 groups. Each group has 30 families, and each group has 5 different working groups, which goes from education, health, communication, which will be the people who will go to the meetings and bring bad feedbacks and, like, reporting backs, and goes to security, and each group has their own kitchen and their own bathroom. And they also have a community kitchen and a community pharmacy where all the donations goes for. And from that, they decide together who has more priority. Like, this group needs more food, so they will send the food to them. They all live in tents right now because it's illegal. So they don't start, like, building houses before get the land legalized. But they had already built, like, 3 houses in the middle of the occupation, which right now they are using that as a place to have meetings, but after, like, when they got legalized, that will be the schools. It's another thing, like, every camp, most of the camps from MSG, they have their own school, so the children from the camp, they go to their school. Also, they have a program to teach people how to read and write. There's a particular camp that I have a closer relationship with, and it's amazing, they just set up this program, has been a few months now, and the first one in the list was a woman with 85 years old. She was the first one to know how to read and write in the list. And all the schools is based on Paulo Freire principles. And so they have a project of uh, you've been agriculture for that camp, that this occupation, which is where the YouTube will provide their own food, so they don't will need like to buy food or whatever. And yeah, they also have stores. There's a store downtown São Paulo where they sell like beans and stuff that comes from the camps, from the community.
That's funny. Do you have a website address or contact info for that?
They have a website. I don't know how it works because like they take a long time like the updating the website, but they do have I'm not sure the address, but like if you search for AMSC you're probably gonna find it, and it's translated to English.
I think the English language website's something like mstbrazil.org. That might be wrong, but that's what I remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
As an organizing strategy, it's interesting. The Zapatistas have done the same thing. They've occupied by different in a way. They've occupied land by armed force, and then so if you go across the line into a village that's sort of under the ceasefire, you can see they're all, you know, they've got their own sort of security apparatus set up, and they've got development workers that they select and bring in to help them with whatever they decide they need assistance with. So they get the technical assistance from outside. And then in some of the larger towns, they're organizing a dual power kind of strategy where there's the government school, and there's the Zapatista school, and there's the government hospital, and there's the Zapatista hospital, and they're doing something similar on a quite a bit smaller scale, but they're doing it there as well.
Yeah. Is Zapatista self-selecting, do you know?
The Zapatistas are primarily Mayan peasants, you know, like all the, so it's the political situation there is very confused because of religious differences and cultural differences, because it's sort of superimposed all on a tribal identity system, but the communities certainly are self-selecting. I mean, there's just massive community support there for that in the communities that are Zapatista. And then there's differences. Some are sort of split, and then you have a lot of big problems in those ones. And then some are not Zapatista. But there's a fairly continuous geographical region of Zapatista communities there that, you know, are all on board.
Kind of interesting how all these different, you know, movements and whatever kind of all blur together about whether or not they are intentional communities or not. Like, one thing that some people have thought that our intentional communities are tree sits, you know, when they do the tree sits and Earth First and all that. And I would say that they're not exactly, because they're not intended to be permanent. And then the same also, like, with Zapatistas, if they're more of a general community, the people who happen to live together, as opposed to people that chose to be there and, you know, free association and all that, then it's not exactly intentional community. But then all these things can also change to become intentional communities. Like a tree sit could decide to have a tree village there for all the time. And I guess also I could talk a little bit about the ACN and some of the ACN projects. So one of the biggest, well, I don't know if it's the biggest project of the ACN. Well, you already know what the ACN is, right? Some anarchist community network. There's some literature, you know, in the free literature part. The biggest projects that we're doing now is actually we want to help form a new federation of anarchist intentional communities. We don't really know of any other anarchist federation of intentional communities that has ever existed before. And, you know, the whole idea of a federation would go right along with the idea of dual power and creating a network of alternative institutions. And yeah, given that this is, you know, such a big project and stuff, one of the things that we're looking for is like any contact info that you guys may have of possibly interested anarchist intentional communities or anti-authoritarian leftist intentional communities, you know, with their street address and stuff, so that we can contact them about this idea. So far, this idea for a federation is in the very beginning stages. You know, it's just an initiative right now. And we haven't even made a real call yet. But one thing that we want to do is make a call that we'll send out among all these intentional communities and among the anarchist movement, kind of like what, you know, what NEFAC did, you know, saying a call for a new federation. We intend on doing that. But we're not really discriminating against national boundaries either, too. So if you know of any anti-authoritarian or anarchist intentional communities, you know, Japan or Brazil or wherever, South America, Europe, if we can get the contact info, that'd be great. And also, one thing that we would need, since we would like to make the call to all these different countries about this initiative for a federation, would be translators, you know, people that speak different languages. So far, we have one person that might be interested to speak Spanish, and one person who might be interested to speak French. But if we get, you know, a lot more French and Spanish speakers and a lot more other languages, too, that'd be really helpful if we want this to be an international call. So I guess I can give you the website address and then the email address if you want to contact me, or you can talk with me later if you have any contact info or are interested in helping out with the project. The website is, you know, www.anarchistcommunitarian.net. And communitarian, if you want to know how to spell that, is C-O-M-M-U-N-I-T-A-R-I-A-N.
.net.
Oh, .net. Because it's Anarchist Communitarian Network, Anarchist Communitarian Net.
And Anarchist Communitarian is one word.
Oh, yeah, one word. And I think it's also on the flyers. And I have a bunch of these brochures over at Twin Oaks that just got made, so I can send these here if you want. It has, like, some of the position papers and explaining why anarchists should support intentional communities and vice versa. And, oh, I don't think the address is... Oh, there's this snail mail address if you're interested in writing. and then there's also an email address, too. The email address is on the website, too, but I can... It's also pretty easy, too. It's anarchistcommunitariannet@hotmail.com. So it's kind of like the, you know, website address, but different. And this, in general, with the ACN, you know, there's all kinds of ways that, you know, work can be done to help out. Like, just, you know, writing articles or finding articles that relate to both subjects, or, you know, distributing ACN-type stuff, or, you know, talking to intentional communities about anarchism, or talking to anarchists about intentional communities, or, you know, anything along that line so you can, you know, be creative. And it's a pretty informal network, too. There's no real structure in it now. It kind of operates on consensus, but we hardly ever make decisions. so we hardly try to use consensus, but I guess... I mean, so far we've been using consensus about the upcoming protests and stuff. We're going to support the anarchist presence there, but we don't know how exactly, because there is no real anarchist call for this protest. Yeah. But, so, yeah, basically, since it's so informal right now, people can do ACN work without having to join anything or whatever. You can just go out and say, I'm working with ACN. But the Federation definitely seems like a pretty daunting task for us now, because we've never really formed a Federation before. And so we don't have experience with it or that much knowledge. And especially since that there's... some anarchist intentional communities that we know of, you know, overseas, and if they're interested in it, then it would be a global federation. So nice. We're going, yeah. And actually, I mean, chances look, there was definitely some interesting anarchist intentional communities out there in overseas. Like, for instance, there's the anarchist kibbutz in Israel, which has been around for about 30 years, and it has about 100 people living there. And then there's, like, you know, some big famous anarchist squats and stuff in Europe and all that.
Is a Zionist anarchist a contradiction in terms?
I don't think they're Zionist. I've never really communicated with them. I would assume that they're anti-Zionist anarchists living in a kibbutz in Israel.
Have you thought about the Mondragon cooperatives as a form of intentional community at all? Do you know about them?
Yeah, aren't they just worker cooperatives?
Yeah, but I mean, it sort of stretches the boundaries of what an intentional community is. But I mean, that's a region of Spain where they have their own healthcare, social security systems, factories,
housing,
yeah, food distribution, product distribution, you know, everything.
Economies of scale, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what they've done. It's not a revolutionary strategy, as far as I can tell, for them, but what they've accomplished is quite incredible.
And personally, I'm, like, not opposed to them at all, but I think that the key thing is to stress the importance of intentional communities, intentional living, you know, and also the anarchist aspects, too.
Yeah.
And I don't think Mondragon calls themselves explicitly anarchist, but hardly anyone does, I noticed, in these movements, even though that they draw a lot from it, too.
They're not interested in coming to conferences to talk about...
They
it's not...
and that's definitely something that probably we also have a general discussion, theoretical discussion email list that you can join and we can talk about this. Like, there's some areas like discovering how to actually get these people with, you know, worker co-ops, intentional communities people interested in anarchism, even though they're already interested in the practice. It's kind of a reverse problem that you would have with normal people, I guess.
Right.
It's kind of like it's kind of like a joke I heard. Was it an anarchist says, you know, yeah, that works great in practice, but how does it work in theory?